J. O'Day, the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this Honorable Court.
Thank you. Please be seated. This morning we have three matters on our oral submission docket. In the order of their presentation, they are Coastal Transport Company Incorporated versus Crown Central Petroleum Corporation from Harris County and the 14th Appellate District. David and Mary Holyback versus Carl Brandenberger and others from McCullough County and the 3rd Appellate District. And Catalina Development and Gregory Collins versus El Paso County from El Paso County and the 8th Appellate District. In each of these matters, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The relator or petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. We will take a brief recess in between each argument and will complete the arguments by noon. All of these arguments are being recorded by our clerk, and you may purchase a tape of any argument for a nominal fee. We are pleased to welcome with us today District Judge Dale Wainwright of Harris County, who will be joining the court at the first of next year and will be participating. Well, unless we're remarkably efficient, he will participate in the decisions here today. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Coastal versus Crown Central.
May it please the court. Mr. Randy Roach will present argument to the petitioner. Petitioner deserves 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court.
Your Honor, this case concerns the contours of the Maritime Overseas Waiver Rule, specifically that it does not apply to situations where the legal sufficiency challenge is simply incompetent evidence of gross negligence, where there is no probative evidence on the face of the record. I would have thought that this was resolved by anyone reading the last page of this court's decision in Maritime Overseas, where the court plainly says that it does not apply to situations where there are no evidence challenges visible on the face of the record, lacking any probative value. For some reason, the Court of Appeals, Crown, and the amicus that you received yesterday all believe that we are asking this court to extend or modify Maritime Overseas, and nothing could be farther from the truth. The truth is that Maritime Overseas can't apply to any kind of no evidence objection other than something that applies to the expert's methodology or analysis and its reliability. While there is an overlay between reliability of an expert's opinion and no probative evidence to support when an expert gives the only opinion that we think is incompetent, they are still distinct. And while a party can waive its reliability challenge under Maritime Overseas by not raising that issue, certainly you do not at the same time waive your claim that there is no evidence because there's no probative value on the face of that opinion. That's the mistake that everybody else seems to be making, the Court of Appeals and others, saying that there was a waiver when you didn't object to the reliability of that testimony. Yes, Maritime Overseas, that objection is waived. But no, on questions like Burroughs Welcome or Schaefer or Dallas Railway or any other instance where the legal sufficiency claim is there's no probative value to the expert's testimony on the face of the record.
Does that mean that we just do away with a conclusory objection regarding expert opinions? Is it?
Yes.
Do we just don't need that objection anymore?
That we never have, Your Honor. Whenever the expert's opinion has been purely conclusory and lacked any substance, viewable from your perspective on the Court of Appeals or viewable from the trial court's perspective on a motion for directed verdict, we've never needed an objection. The dissent in Maritime Overseas, Justice Gonzalez's opinions, this court has never said anything to the contrary. But if this court were to affirm and to sustain the positions being advocated by Crown, by Mr. Fisher and others, That's what you would be doing. You would be requiring an objection to purely incompetent testimony. And it seems to me that the practical ramifications of that simply are difficult to justify in a jurisprudential sense and in a practical trial courtroom sense. From the jurisprudential sense, we would be doing away with that portion of no evidence practice that we have always had in this state, saying where you have no probative value to the expert's testimony, that you have legally insufficient evidence. That would be gone if it was waived without objection.
Let me ask you a question. Let's assume the court goes with you that the Robinson-Daubert issue didn't do away with the right of a person who loses on an issue to raise a legally no evidence, a no evidence challenge, without having to have objected to any particular testimony during the trial of the case. The dissent in Maritime versus Ellis makes no distinction between a reliability on what would be raised by Daubert and Robinson and a standard no evidence. They say it's still a no evidence challenge. You can still make it with regard to, I guess, evidence rule 702 on expert witnesses, that it's no evidence. But it seems to me that the reason you have a Robinson-Daubert challenge is because the court can't decide the reliability issue of the expert's testimony in the area of science. I mean, a judge can't sit there and say that your methodology is no good unless the judge himself or herself is a scientist in that area. So it does seem to me that there's a valid role for a waiver of a Daubert challenge because the appellate court can't assess reliability without the assistance of some sort of scientific challenge here. But how does this court decide when a challenge based on the reliability evidence is properly preserved just by a motion for direct verdict and a challenge this waived where the reliability issue depends on the science that's used in determining that opinion? How do we parse those issues?
I think this court's opinions set that test, and I think it's whether or not the problem, the challenge, is apparent on the face of the record, or if it's not. Your situation, Judge, where there's a scientific testimony, unreliability, and it's not visible on the face of the record, and you instead have to have a fuller record developed before an appellate court could evaluate whether or not it is or is not reliable, that error can be waived and that error should be waived. But that's not this case. Where the error is visible purely on the face of the record before you.
Do you include in that unreliability? I mean, if you could show unreliability on the face of the record, are you saying you don't need to object?
I know that was the position the dissent took, and I know that position was not accepted in Maritime Overseas, and I'm not asking the court to change that.
Because it seems like
I'm
it's easier to state than to apply. I mean, whether something's unreliable or probative, I mean, it's easy to state those terms, but in actually applying the test, it's much more difficult, isn't it?
Not on a no probative value on the face of the record because the evidence is incompetent. In a case such as this, maybe it's rare. I don't think it is. I think it's not that rare. But where you only have an expert opinion on a bare naked opinion on a question of law, and that's it, and there's no support for that naked opinion. It's not probative on the face of the record, and there isn't any need for any additional development. In this case, for example, Crown does not say that they needed any additional evidence to be put in the record. They don't say there was any appeal by ambush because this issue was raised by motion to verdict, but to your question, Judge, because it's not necessary. It's just a bare, naked opinion or conclusion by an expert on a question of law, and whether it's the parties had an agreement, the street was one way, the injury was in course and scope, all questions of law, or here, where actual subjective awareness of an extreme degree of risk. Those are all expert, bare, naked opinions on a question of law by an expert. And the absence of any probative value on that question is obvious. I mean, that's the nature of incompetent evidence. It's obvious. No reasonable mind could disagree.
I thought your position was this is not a reliability challenge.
We didn't make a reliability challenge. And we're not claiming we preserved a reliability challenge. But we're saying there is a fundamental difference this court has always recognized between reliability and no probative value. Complaint.
Well, but you're saying it has no probative value because of the underlying data doesn't support it.
Yes, just like...
Which sounds like reliability, just by another term.
Sure, it overlaps with reliability. No question. You can say this evidence has no probative value.
Well, the opinion's unreliable because it's relying on bad data or wrong data, so therefore it's unreliable.
You could say that. But that's not to say that there isn't also a distinction where the two are different. Okay? You could say that no probative value is a reliability issue. It needlessly confuses no probative value with the things that properly are the subject of maritime overseas waiver. But really, the question ought to be a functional one. Do you really need to say there's a waiver absent an objection to something that is plainly incompetent on the face of the record?
It seems to me what this all boils down to is what kind of probe was used to replace the original probe. Am I right or wrong?
Yes, it focuses on the replacement probe as opposed to the original bad pepper.
What is the evidence about what kind of probe was used as replacement probe? Was it another creepy crawler problem probe, or was that a wholly different kind of probe?
Well, it is the absence of any evidence that says that anybody knew that the replacement probe had any kind of defect, had creepy crawler problems. No actual subjective awareness by Coastal. That's the issue. There is no evidence of that, and that's why the evidence opinion to the contrary is unsupported.
I think her question is narrower. It's what was actually put in. It was the placement probe, in fact, identical to the original probe, regardless of anybody's knowledge.
Well, okay, that is a different question.
Yeah, but I think
that was my question. They seem to say there's evidence that that Coastal still had on the shelves the old kind of probe that could develop a creepy crawler problem, and they seem to say we don't know whether the replacement probe was the old style probe that could develop creepy crawler problems or was a new, differently designed probe. And I'm trying to, the briefs don't really seem to hone in on that.
That's because the evidence in the record is not clear about what the material was. There has been an inference from the fact that the post-accident investigation showed some creepy crawler problem, that there must have been, this replacement probe must have been a creepy crawler problem either from the original bad batch or that the replacements were creepy crawler suspects. But that's the problem. If we don't have clear evidence on that, and that's the only thing that the expert really criticized, and this is vitally important, it's in our brief, the expert can't be heard to say Coastal actually knew that the replacement probes were creepy crawler susceptible because he says, in his ordinary negligence analysis, that a reasonable, ordinary, prudent company would have found out if replacement probes had a creepy crawler problem or were from the same batch. And they failed to do that. Now, you can't simultaneously maintain that a company failed to find out whether the replacement was creepy crawler defective, and at the same time say they actually knew that it was creepy crawler defective. Okay? That's what his opinion is asserted to constitute, evidence that Tolstoy actually had subjective awareness that the replacement probes had the creepy crawl problem in it.
Can't you be so consciously indifferent to the welfare of others that it rises to actual knowledge? And then doesn't that go back to Burke loyalty and before? And it's still the law of the day.
Well, if you knew that what you were putting in was effective and with an extreme degree of risk could cause serious injury, absolutely. But that's obviously not this case, Your Honor, because there was no knowledge in the first place of any problem with the replacement probes.
But I guess Dave's saying it's evidence that you allowed the old creepy crawler probes to stay on the shelf so that you could have pulled off the shelf as a replacement probe the old style creepy crawler probe.
No evidence that that happened. That is purely speculation. The evidence that is in the record from Pena, from Pierce, the truck driver, and from the manager of Fiddle, all says it was came out of a box, it was new, and Pena says, the repairman says, I fixed the bad probe. That's the only evidence there is on the replacement probes. The possibility that they were still on the shelf is not in evidence. There's no factual evidence that that occurred. That is the speculation, possibly, of the expert, that there was a risk of that. But he didn't say that it happened. He just said the risk that that could happen is something that Coastal knew about and should have done something about.
Let me ask you on the risk. I'm trying to figure out the extreme risk of extreme harm category. When you're dealing with a dangerous circumstance, it's not clear when I was looking at the briefing how often there were explosions from the creepy crawler problem. It looked like the evidence indicated that the creepy crawler problem here could lead to this event happening, and there was an experience with that event happening. What relationship does that have to being? Isn't the extreme risk, meaning the likelihood that it will happen, as opposed to how serious the damages will be if it happens? Or
yes.
I mean, see, so
that's
what
right.
happened the on this extreme risk?
The likelihood of it happening from a replacement probe is the issue in this case. They're confusing it. The likelihood of it happening from a batch probe is completely different because there was remedial action, like an Andrade or Fong or Sanchez. But the likelihood of it happening from a replacement probe, zero evidence. The bad batch probe, one fire in 1989, three incidents of overspill that no one tied directly to creepy crawlers. Company didn't know about it being creepy crawler. And then this incident. There are other overspills, but they happen for other reasons.
But how, in relationship to how often they're using the probes and doing the filling, was that one incident demonstrating that it was likely to happen if they had creepy crawler? Or what, I mean, what's the record on that?
If we're talking bad probes, we would say there was a risk that needed to be addressed.
But is that negligence or is that gross negligence?
Purely negligence, because it takes actual knowledge that the replacement probes have a problem and being consciously indifferent to having replacement probes with that risk. There was never any incident, maybe this answers your question, never any incident with a replacement probe that is in this record prior to this accident.
When is it appropriate, or was it appropriate here for a court of appeals, assuming that we agree with the court that there is evidence of gross negligence, to remand for a trial on gross negligence only when liability has been contested throughout the case?
Well, this was a directed verdict, Your Honor, and it seems to me if you find that there was evidence that there was evidence that could have gone to a jury, remanding it back on the gross negligence issue alone. Might make sense, but it seems to me if you don't have ordinary.
Correctly.
Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear arguments from this phone.
May it please the court. And the argument for this file.
May it please the court, I'm John Hagan. I represent Crown Central Petroleum Corporation this morning. The first issue that I want to address is whether there's any evidence in this case of a temporary injury to Crown's property. Then I will briefly address the gross negligence and Maritime versus Ellis issue. The facts that relate to the injury to Crown's property are not in dispute. On September 23, 1993, there was a fire that completely destroyed the bulk loading gasoline terminal on Crown's property in Pasadena, Texas. Prior to that fire, the property was an income-producing property. It was returning a net income of $1 million a year to Crown Central's bottom line. It had a pre-fire fair market value of $5 million. After the fire, the net income stream from that property was reduced to zero, and the fair market value was reduced to the value of the raw land of $130,000. It is not disputed in this case that the fire reduced the fair market value of Crown Central's property. The legal question is whether or not the injury on the undisputed facts was a permanent injury as a matter of law.
Is it also undisputed that it could have been rebuilt to its former value, to its former usefulness for $600,000?
It is not in dispute, Your Honor, that the terminal could have been rebuilt. They could have built another terminal to replace the one that was destroyed by fire. That is not, was not necessarily proven at trial, and there certainly was no issue on this, that the full value of that property would have been restored.
Well, the jury made a finding, which you don't contest, of what it would cost to replace.
We have not challenged that finding, but we do challenge whether it's full and fair compensation for the injury.
Because of your lost income, or solely because once it's destroyed, you think you're entitled to this other value, the before and after value?
Well, it's a combination of both. We do believe that the proper measure in this case for the loss in its entirety that Crown Central suffered is the diminution in fair market value. But in addition, Crown Central was losing the net income from that property to the tune of $1 million a year from the time of the incident in September 1993, and it continues certainly up through the time of trial, and to this very day, it continues to be losing the economic, income stream from that particular property.
So did you ask the jury for your lost profits from the damage to the property?
We asked the jury to find that it was a permanent injury.
But you're talking about the economic damages to the loss of business, aren't you? I mean, if you're saying, well, we lost an income stream, well, that's your profits from the business. So isn't that where you would ask the jury for your damages?
We did not ask the jury for the profits from the business. What we asked the jury was find that this is a permanent injury and determine what was the diminution in fair market value. That measure of damages is calculated under the facts of this case to give the Crown full compensation for its loss. If this court were to find in favor of Crown Central and find that it was a permanent injury, but only award the cost of repair and loss of use for some limited time found by the jury, Crown would not be fully compensated for its loss.
I have a hard time understanding the discrepancy in the numbers, frankly. Let's suppose that a downtown skyscraper was destroyed. Do you measure the diminution of value by the difference between the property with the skyscraper on it and the property with the skyscraper off of it in perpetuity? I mean, nobody would leave that vacant lot downtown vacant forever to determine market value.
Well, Your Honor, your question really addresses what are the ways that the law has developed and recognized for valuing the fair market value of a piece of property. And there are three approaches that are recognized: the market approach, the cost approach, and the income capitalization approach. These three approaches are recognized by not only courts in Texas, but courts in many jurisdictions. For an income-producing property, the correct approach
which is what the jury found in its answer to the question submitted to it, was that using the income capitalization approach was the correct way to value this property. I think it's important to point out from the record that Coastal and Crown both put on experts who testified as to the fair market value issue. The theory under which the case was tried was that if it's a permanent injury, fair market value is the measure of damages. If it was temporary, they argued it was a different measure of damages.
I guess my basic question is, in arriving at fair market value, did the experts assume that nothing would be rebuilt on the property?
Yes. In the approach that David Lewis took as for using income capitalization approach, he did not take into account whether anything would or would not be built. He simply looked, what would a willing buyer, willing seller, value it before the property, before the fire and after the fire. And he took into account, which is the proper approach that appraisers follow, entrepreneurial profit. Someone who was looking to buy that property before the fire would not simply look at it in terms of paying what it would cost to build a replacement property somewhere else. They would look at the income earning potential of that property in reaching fair market value.
But you wouldn't, but they would also have to factor in, what you're talking about is a permanent loss of value in the property. If this had been some sort of pollution spill that occurred out there so that the property could not be used for what it had been originally designed to be used for, then one of the measures of damage would be what was the income stream before the damage and what's going to be the income stream after the damage. But following up on Justice Owen's question, if there's nothing that prohibits you from building that skyscraper back on that property, you certainly couldn't expect that the fact that the skyscraper was destroyed to be a permanent damage to the property. You'd have to have evidence that you can't build the skyscraper again because of what occurred on the property. Isn't that correct?
No, I don't believe that is correct, Your Honor, because if that
So you think that if the building is destroyed, you can have an appraiser get up there and say the property value has been reduced by the loss of that building, and that's permanent damage, even though the evidence is that the building can be rebuilt?
Yes, because what the law looks at for permanent damages has been, the standard rule that's been followed for many, many years is you look at the reduction in fair market value immediately before versus immediately after the injury. If this court were to adopt the what you might be suggesting, the court would be imposing on property owners an unbounded duty to always rebuild their property in order to minimize the loss or to reduce the loss or eliminate the loss that has been caused by the tortfeasor. There's no case, and I've looked, there's no case that I've found that imposes that type of heavy duty on a property owner to remedy the harm caused by the tortfeasor.
I guess I just don't understand the numbers here, because if I were to buy, I looked at what the income producing stream was with the skyscraper on it, and if it only cost me $6 million to replace the skyscraper in a year's loss of income, it seems like the diminution in market value, just from a logical standpoint, would be the cost to rebuild the skyscraper plus a loss of year's income. It wouldn't be a loss of 10 years of income.
Well, that is why the loss of 10 years of income, you know, into some indefinite time in the future is exactly why the law has recognized the reduction in fair market value as an appropriate measure. But to address...
I'm looking at market value.
Address your question. Both experts, David Lewis and Mr. Beezer, or Coastal in this case, testified that the cost approach valuing that property was inappropriate. Now, the cost approach is a method for valuing property that basically takes the cost of replacing the facility, less depreciation, and then some reasonable time for lost use.
And why don't those match up? That's what I can't logically understand.
Because that approach does not capture all of the value that is inherent in income-producing property. This was a unique piece of property.
But if you restore it just like it was before, what have you lost? That's what I'm having hard time understanding.
You've lost the income stream from that property.
But only for a short period of time.
But that would require this court to say that property owners always had a duty within some hypothetical reasonable time to rebuild.
Now, I'm just
property.
Saying from a buyer's standpoint, you say, I'm going to buy that, you know, the only reason I'm going to buy that property is to put an income stream back on the property. So you would factor all that into what a willing buyer is willing to pay for the property and market value.
Well,
as is. I mean, that's what I don't understand, why there's such a huge discrepancy between the market value and the cost to replace the facility.
Well, Coastal, I understand that it's difficult to understand perhaps that $4,870,000 value found by the jury for the reduction in fair market value, which is what Mr. Lewis testified to. That finding has not been challenged. There's no challenge brought that the methodology that Mr. Lewis used to value the property was somehow invalid or inappropriate.
Let me ask you about your legal assumption. If these were merchants and we were talking about a good for sale, you would admit that the UCC imposes a duty to cure. You don't have to cure, but that's going to be the limits of the amount of money you walk away from the deal, right?
Yes, the UCC does contain a cure provision.
And what's wrong with that type of concept for real property, whether that was the law in 1887 or not? What's wrong with the concept that you can get the amount of money it would take to rebuild it and the loss of income flow in the meantime? If you don't want to rebuild it, that's all you're going to get.
Well, for one thing, Your Honor, it conflicts with two of the opinions of this court in cases that
involved cracked slabs and damage from diverted flood water onto the property.
These
two cases are not in the brief, but I would ask the court to consider them. Blood versus McCollum, which is at 762 Southwest 2nd 575. It's a 1988 decision of this court.
And
as well as Parkway versus Woodruff, which is at 901 Southwest 2nd 828, a 1995 decision. In both of those cases, the amount found to repair the damage to the property was less than the reduction in fair market value before repairs were made. And this court, in both of those cases, in the Love versus McCollum case, this court affirmed the appellate court's award of the greater measure of damages, which was the reduction in fair market value.
I can understand that, yeah, your car is hit, and they repair it, but the fact that it's been around makes it less valuable. You can't overcome that with repairs. I guess I'm still having a hard time understanding, what is it about the injury to this property that you can never restore in terms of market value by replacing a facility?
Well, it wasn't. Perhaps the way to look at it is this. Before the fire, Grant had sold that property for $5 million
because it was an
income earning property.
Crown could have sold the property for $5 million, and it could have done what it did after this fire, which is it leased space at another terminal and sold its refinery products there
and received an income stream from that.
Crown had both of those options. They could have not only sold product at its terminal and received $1 million a year, but it could have sold other product at another terminal. But after the fire, that was gone. All the Crown could do was sell its products at another terminal, and it had lost a book asset on its bottom line of $5 million, reduced down to $130,000, found by the jury on the evidence.
I think it's also important to remember in this case on the